Mr. Petrocelli was rocking back and forth on the edge of his chair, his face unnaturally red, his smile beaming. The excitement of the moment had obviously spiked his blood pressure. I wondered how soon before the next heart attack. I wondered if he'd make his goal of living long enough to see his daughter's body recovered. We drained our coffee cups, just to be polite. Mr. Petrocelli seemed reluctant for us to depart, shaking our hands again and again. When we finally made it out to the car, Mr. Petrocelli stood on the front porch, waving, waving, waving. My last glance of him was as we drove down the street. He became a small, hunch-shouldered old man, face too red, smile too bright, still waving determinedly at the police detective he firmly believed would finally bring his daughter home. "You faxed the sketch to Catherine Gagnon," I said, the moment we hit the highway. "Why?" "Your father showed Catherine his sketch when she was in the hospital," he said abruptly.
"He did?"
"I want to see if it's the same drawing."
"But that's not possible.
Catherine was in the hospital in 80, and that sketch wasn't done until 2 years later."
"How do you know?"
"Because the stalker dude didn't start delivering gifts until August of 1982. And you can't have a sketch of the stalker dude without any stalker."
"There's only one problem with that."
"There is?"
"According to the police reports, no one ever saw the face of the stalker dude. Not your father or mother, not Mrs. Watts, and not any of your neighbors. In theory, therefore, stalker dude could not have served as the basis for that drawing."
Well, that was a stumper. I stewed on it, telling myself there was a logical explanation while realizing I was using that line a lot lately. My father had known something in 1980, I decided. Something serious enough to drive him to masquerade as an FBI agent and visit Catherine with a sketch in hand. But what? I tried searching my memory banks. I'd been only 5 in 1980, living in Arlington, and I couldn't get anything to come to mind. Not even the memory of a comic strip wrapped gift. I was certain those started arriving 2 years later, when I was 7. The silence was finally broken by the chirping of the cell phone clipped to Bobby's waist. He retrieved it, exchanged a few terse words, slid a look at me sideways. He flipped it shut, seemed about to speak, then the phone rang again. This time his voice was different, polite, professional, the voice of a detective addressing a stranger. He seemed to be trying to work out a meeting, and it wasn't going his way.
"When do you leave for the conference?"
"I'll be honest, sir, I need to meet with you as soon as possible. It involves one of your former professors, Russell Granger."
Even I could hear the sudden squawk on the other end of the line, and then, that quickly, Bobby was nodding.
"Where do you live again?"
"Lexington. As a matter of fact, I happen to be right around the corner."
He glanced at me. I answered with a shrug, grateful that I didn't have to elaborate. Obviously, Bobby was trying to set up an interview with my father's former boss, and obviously, it needed to happen now. I didn't mind. Of course, there was no way in hell I was waiting in the car.